From Aspen Public Radio, this is Curated, stories on the art and the artists who visit and live in the Roaring Fork Valley. I'm Claire Woodcock, arts and culture reporter here at Aspen Public Radio. It is Monday, June 19th, and today's episode is part one of an exploration, albeit loose, into the influences literature can have on music and that music can have on literature. It's a convenient time for us to be having this conversation in the Valley with Aspen Word's Summer Word Series happening this week and Jazz Aspen Snowmass's June experience kicking off Friday. On today's program, an editor shares what she looks for when considering manuscripts, and Jazz Aspen Snowmass's founder discusses new JAS education programming and the forthcoming June experience. Plus, music and existentialist stories from Americana musician Shaky Graves, and details on other events happening this week in the Valley. Tuesday marks the official start to summer, and the art scene throughout the Valley is about to heat up. So thanks for tuning in, and let's go. Carol DeSanti is vice president and executive editor with Viking Penguin Publishing Company. She's back in town for Aspen Word's Summer Series and joins me now to give editorial advice and talk events through Summer Words. How do you see your role as an editor in championing the voices of contemporary authors?
All along and from the first, I feel like my work is, as an acquisitions editor, is first and foremost to listen. It's a kind of listening that I really started to learn as a young person, when I was using library books to kind of fill in the gaps from what I wasn't hearing from the adults around me. And I really looked for and listened for voices that helped me to grow up and understand who I was and show me a way into a world that seemed very confusing and full of conflict and show me kind of a way to chart the course. But as a professional editor, I listen for something elemental about a voice, some quality that contributes to my understanding, something that shows me, that tells me something new, that opens up a window in my mind. Is it enlivening? Is it inspiring? Does it explain something? Do I want to spend time with this voice? Do I want to pick it up if I have to put it down, which often happens when I'm reading submissions. So I try to listen beyond the clutter, beyond the static. The essence of it needs to be that I feel like there's something really here that I connect with and I'm excited about. And then once I find a way to talk about it and translate it to the group that I work with here in-house, and I will present to them and bounce ideas and themes and stories off them to gauge interest and get a sense of the questions, their doubts, their excitement, their totally blank stares. You know, not everyone agrees, and sometimes you have to go out on a limb, too, and say, well, nobody else is getting this, but I do. You just have to trust me on it. So, you know, being an editor is a kind of a poker game. You need to know when to fold and when to hold.
So what are you listening for when you review manuscripts?
You know, I guess that's a good question, and it's one that I wish I had a great answer to. I'm listening for something that gets beyond the noise, and I don't think that everybody does that. I think some readers really love the noise and want more noise to fill the space. I'm looking for something that takes me to a quieter place. I think in the end, I'm looking for, reading for, listening for some kind of wisdom and some kind of vision and the places that great books, that great works of literature ultimately take us to. And I have a pretty broad definition of what's a great work of literature. You know, I joke with some of my authors that would Moby Dick be published today, for example? Would War and Peace have been cut to bits and turned into a novella? Yeah, I know there has to be some accounting for popular taste and popular attention spans and all of that, but it's like when you read it and you hear it, you just know it. And nobody really knows what that is or what makes it happen or what makes it work. But, you know, when I was a young editor and I read the 30 early pages of Dorothy Allison's Bastard Out of Carolina, I jumped out of my chair and ran down the hall to the person who was my boss at that time, and I just didn't shut up until he said, okay, we'll make an offer on this book. And it's kind of been like that with the other books that I've taken on that have really made their way in the world.
So how do you perceive that depth from a novelist like, say, Elena Ferrante?
You know, I was kind of put off by those books, by the covers, I think. I was being sort of a snob and thinking, I don't know, I didn't really like the cover, right? So a friend of mine who I really respect, and that's sometimes how we get our greatest recommendations, right, from someone whose taste we know this person is really on it. She said, no, you must read these books. And I said, okay, I must read them. And I was absolutely blown away. I had not had a reading experience like that in a long time. I think it's because, and she's written about this, I'm now reading Frantumaglia, and that's a collection of her letters and essays and responses to readers and comments about her writing and her process as a writer in the world. She has a commitment to a fidelity about the truth as a woman and rendering that with such surgical precision and not making it one bit less complicated than it is, that is really the most ferocious and fearless examination of these things that I think I've ever come across. Many writers just skirt these issues or obscure them in some way. Ferrante is writing about being female and the ways in which a woman is warped and deformed by a patriarchal culture, how women experience that, and how they need to go on and live it and try for a full, balanced life. It makes for a kind of doubling back and doubting and questioning what's real. And the way she writes about what she calls dissolving boundaries is a lot of sort of the theme of the Neapolitan novels. How we make ourselves, how we remake ourselves. It's writing that makes you, at least makes me, more than a little uncomfortable. It's kind of like realizing that you have a pebble in your shoe and you've been walking on it and walking on it all these years and you thought that's just the way shoes were, that the stone can't ever, you know, be removed. And then you realize that you can remove it, but first you have to sit down on the ground because there's not even a bench and the ground is damp and you have to take the shoe off and get rid of that nasty thing. And that's the ground of being and experience that she, Ferrante, pairs her characters down to. And there's such beauty and power in it, and such a raw, kind of dark and ancient place. And now I'm laughing at myself because, of course, in the Neapolitan novels, Lila makes these stunning designs for Italian shoes in the Neapolitan novels, and I wasn't even thinking about that. Lila makes shoes that have never before been seen, and I think maybe it's that Ferrante is saying, we can't walk in those other shoes. Look what Lila and Lenu, these two young girls, these friends, and then women with such a complicated, conflicted love for each other did about that.
That's so funny that you mentioned the cover of those books, because I haven't read those books personally, and I think that the covers were part of the reason for me as well. It seems like there are definitely these societal connections from the Neapolitan times versus today that you're going to draw on in your workshops that you'll be leading.
Yeah, I can't wait. I mean, I think that it's really going to be fun to talk to people about these books and find out what connections have been made for others. I was at a party, and you know how you're at parties and you know you're talking to someone and you don't know who they are. You've just met them and you think you make this kind of snap judgment like, oh, I don't have anything in common with this person. You know, I have to like stop this conversation and find a way out. And I was talking to someone kind of like that. And then somehow we got onto Ferrante, and she had read Ferrante too. And all of a sudden we just like dropped into a different world. And we were talking about Ferrante and getting more and more excited. And everybody around us was like, what are you guys talking about? And pretty soon half the room was talking about Ferrante. And it was just one of those kind of, kindling experiences that happens sometimes. And I'm hoping that that's what the workshop is like, too. It's going to be really fun. I've never done anything like this before, so it's going to be new to me.
So you're going to be moderating a couple of discussions this week during Aspen Word's Summer Word Series. And one of the big questions that's going to be posed is, how can literature forge connections and shape public conversation around critical issues without polarizing readership? That is such a loaded question, but do you have a quick answer?
Literature it has to do what it's always done throughout history, and our history has been a long and difficult one as human beings on the planet. It has to remind us of the way to our hearts. It has to teach our souls how to be better, one by one, person by person. And that's kind of the simplest, shortest view of it. That's ultimately literature's job, its only job. The great books of history unite us. They don't divide us. They're our teachers, and we know when we're ready for having read them.
That was Viking Penguins Vice President and Executive Editor Carol DeSanti speaking with Aspen Public Radio. For details on the Reader's Retreat led by DeSanti and panel discussions through Summer Words, visit aspenwords.org. Now for what's on heavy rotation here at APR's Arts and Culture Desk. Alejandro Rose Garcia is the Texas Americana musician behind Shaky Graves, an artist with existentialism on the mind. I spoke with Rose Garcia by phone last week as he was preparing to record part of his new album at Kevin Costner's Aspen home.
The whole idea is that they're actually really old songs. I mean, I must have recorded with her in 2007, something like that. Since I first started making music, I must have had recorded, you know, somewhere in the range of 100-something songs, you know, ranging in quality from, like, absolutely unlistenable to stuff that I've put on albums and kind of everywhere in between. But I guess part of me, I guess there's two sides of it. Like, part of me feels sort of like it drives me crazy when musicians maybe have too much music out and I don't know where to start. I think it's just kind of like a content, sort of a content filter. I would rather someone be into what I do before they listen to kind of like rougher stuff that I have. It's just sort of a quality control thing, I guess, for me. I've always liked Wither, but it's got that kind of lo-fi. It's a lo-fi song because it was recorded very cheaply in my bedroom when I didn't know what was going on. And then it was hissy and stuff like that. So I've remastered it a few times. And then, like, you know, I still keep going back to it. So eventually it kind of passed the test. And I was like, I got to find some way to re-release this. The album that's coming out is two EPs that I have, one of which is called Donor Blues. And that you've always been able to sort of buy. But I've never put it on iTunes or Spotify or anything like that. So you can get it off of Bandcamp. But again, I mean, I guess what's kind of cool is it's been hidden in plain sight. So the average Spotify listener or iTunes explorer would never really come across it. It's got a quality of songwriting that, you know, that I really like in my own music. It would be the kind of stuff that if I, you know, not myself, those would be the albums of mine I would listen to, the ones that kind of sound like that.
They'll keep her guessing till the very end. Really, she hopes that's how it goes.
Songs that I used to write or the albums that I used to put together are kind of ever more valid for me because I get to kind of look back at myself at a certain time when I especially wasn't writing music with anyone waiting for it, you know? Like nobody was excited about the next or any album that I put out, I guess, at this point when I was writing some of these songs. So there was sort of a kind of a desperation and sort of a sense of freedom and just kind of pure expression that I was putting out. It wasn't like I wasn't intending for people to ever find them, but it was more like I wasn't really worried about it. which, you know, I mean, believe it or not, like, the more that people have paid attention, the more I'm like, am I saying something? Is this stupid? You know, it's like, it's a lot easier to be kind of overly self-aware when people have their attention on you, you know. But yeah, I think a lot of the topics that I was working with or working through, I guess, at the point when I was about 19, kind of 19 through 24-ish, 25, was, yeah, like a lot of just kind of existential stuff, just sort of the basic kind of who am I and why. Because at that point, I was living in L.A. and trying to be an actor, which was something that I always grew up doing and seemed very creative, and, you know, I love acting. But then I was kind of faced with the reality of what it's like to be in the acting industry in Los Angeles, which is really crazy and sort of like one of the weirdest places a 19-year-old person can try and be, you know. And so, yeah, a lot of it was written kind of begging for some sort of escape or for something like, you know, love to save me. And, you know, I didn't really have any significant others that, I would sort of write about some conglomerate person, some sort of imaginary girl that was like the people that I had lost or the girl that I was looking for kind of smashed up into some fictional person that I would write songs to. I mean, you know, stuff like Wither. I think what's nice is that it got a lot of universal stuff across, just because it wasn't so specific to a person, that I was kind of writing generally about the concepts of love, or just sort of generally about what it's like to ponder existential stuff. You know, I just actually woke up from a dream today where I was playing with myself as a baby. I was at a Billy Gibbons concert at this place that I had been before, but, you know, I just turned 30, I guess, last week. So been thinking about it more, like, what is stuff? So, you know, I'm excited to be writing an album or trying to write new music right now, because a lot has changed in my life and kind of is changing. And even the last, you know, actual album that I put out was in 2014. So that meant that, you know, that was stuff that I was writing the year before that. And that was very specific about those times. And a lot has changed in my life since then. So I'm really just kind of have my fingers crossed that I'm able to convey what I am feeling, because I'm feeling a lot of weird stuff. Good stuff, bad stuff, weird stuff. I mean, it's just sort of the continuous collecting of memories and stuff like that. Sort of things happening again. And I live in the house that I grew up in right now, but I ended up taking it over from my mother. But she still lives like, it's like a two house on one property scenario. And this other woman, when I was growing up, always lived in this front house, and we lived in the back house. And so now my mother lives in the front house. I'm helping her kind of take care of that. And then I have the back house, which was always a fantasy of mine, and where I actually, for instance, like Wither was written in the bedroom that I now is my bedroom. But that was like, I went and rented a drum kit, you know? So like, that was like me playing drums on that when I was 20 or something like that, and I did not know how to play drums. So I still have these very visceral memories of me and like a tape 4-track machine and just kind of faking it. Like, I never did it in a single take. I would do like, I'd play the same part over and over again and then nail it and be like, stop, you know, and then do it again and then combine them all. And now, in a very surreal kind of dreamlike way, just like hanging out with myself as a toddler, I'm back occupying the same space that I was at that time, but I'm a very different person. It doesn't feel like it, but I am.
Again, Alejandro Rose Garcia, the Americana musician behind Shaky Graves. The songs Wither and Nobody's Fool played underneath this interview and are both songs he wrote nearly a decade ago, which he released last month as two new singles from his new forthcoming album. Shaky Graves is set to play Belly Up Aspen Tuesday with Denver's Strange Americans. This will be one of many awesome shows the Roaring Fork Valley is getting this week. Joining me to run through the June experience and to discuss new programming is Jim Horowitz, Jazz Aspen Snowmass's founder and executive director.
So, can you tell me about some of the new programs coming out of Jazz Aspen?
Well, I would say the biggest new program is the series of interviews that we're going to be doing with artists, of which Lisa Fisher and John Batiste are the first. The series is called Listen Up. It's aimed at adults, and it's really listen up like when you were a kid and you're Mom may have said, listen up. It means like pay attention. But in this case, it's paying attention to what's behind the music. So it's our effort to give the artists a chance to talk using words as opposed to the music that they use on stage, and actually explain a little bit about the musical background of what they're doing, whether it's musicological or personal, just to help people put their music in context. I guess that would maybe be the simplest way to think about it. So that series starts with Lisa Fisher and John Batiste, and I'm going to interview them at a Sunday brunch earlier in the day of when she plays later that day with Tower of Power that evening. And then it continues at three different shows of Jazz Cafe artists over the summertime, three different artists that will each do a before the first show's dinner, kind of 5:30 p.m. Doors are usually open at 6, but this will be 5:30. So if you're going to come in for the 7 o'clock show, you can come in early, catch the pre-show artist interview, and then go right into dinner and show. And you'll be home in bed by 8:30.
Awesome. And why this Listen Up program? What is the intention of it?
Well, the intention of it is really it's about audience development, I would say. And it's about educating adult audiences. Maybe that's the simplest way to think about it, because in our estimation, or experience, I should say, a more educated audience is more likely to be an audience for the music that you're presenting and trying to help nurture, which is our relationship to jazz and related forms of music. We are constantly, I won't say we're surprised, we're no longer surprised, but we are constantly noting how many people come to our shows who enjoy them tremendously but simply have no real reference point. So they're not even sure what they're listening to. Many of them will say something like, you know, I really don't like jazz all that much, but I really enjoyed this show. And the show, in fact, was a jazz artist doing this is an artist, if you actually understand the music, you would say, no, that's definitely a jazz artist. And that was a performance. It wasn't, okay, it wasn't a pure jazz show, but it was a jazz musician's take on maybe music that you were very familiar with, but which they reinvented. So building a body of knowledge in audiences is our goal. So we're trying to educate adult audiences so that they will appreciate that music even more, and not just love it, but just by understanding it a little bit more, maybe that will just increase their appreciation for it a little bit more. That's what our experience has been.
Yeah, I don't know if I trust anyone that says that they don't like jazz.
Yeah, that's a whole nother point. But there are a lot of people out there, you know, I understand your feeling. But it is just wildly, in some cases, it's not their fault. They just haven't been exposed to the right jazz, because jazz, there's a lot of jazz out there. And I could say, well, like you, if somebody likes jazz, I probably feel like I have a good basis of something in common with them. But I have met many people along the way of doing this who really just had not really been around, I can only say, the right jazz. I don't know what else to say, or jazz that they just responded to, because one person's right is another person's wrong. It's like, not even a judgment call. It's just they never heard any jazz that they liked.
Like, do you have to find like a certain type of jazz? Are there different types of jazz?
There absolutely are different types of jazz. Jazz has many, many, many sub-genres. You know, maybe the way the classical world used to be, with there was the Baroque era, and then there was the Romantic era, and all kinds of different styles, if you could say, that the music somewhat evolved through. Jazz had its own history like that, because jazz is relatively young music. I mean, it's, you know, 100 years, maybe 100 years old, maybe a little bit more, but not much more. Certainly nothing like classical music, which goes, you know, European classical music goes back way longer, and there's all kinds of folk music, which is ancient. But jazz is very, very difficult to categorize, because after it really went through, you could discern genres of the music, from early music through the big band era, through the swing era, to bebop, to cool jazz, to modern jazz, to fusion jazz. There were epics of this music that have now been enshrined in jazz history as genres or subgenres of the music. But now, Oh, and that doesn't even touch on all of the kinds of music which are, that we lump into what we call jazz spoken globally, our series, which is jazz that has to do with other cultures and how they've taken indigenous music and fused it with jazz rhythm and jazz improvisation and come up with forms of music which you could call Latin jazz or Caribbean jazz or French gypsy jazz. There's a lot of them that are out there. So you're talking about it like a peacock of colors and styles, and jazz is just vast. So I would say that to get people to understand the breadth of what is out there is, would be our overarching goal, but you have to show up a lot to really get it all.
Yeah, you gotta show up at the venue.
That was Jim Horwitz, founder and executive director of Jazz Aspen Snowmass. The JAS June Experience kicks off this week. You just heard a bit from John Batiste. Here's a little bit more. This is 2 degrees east, 3 degrees west. Band leader from Stephen Colbert. Other sets will feature musicians like Michael McDonald, Earth, Wind & Fire, Lisa Fisher and Grand Baton, and Tower of Power beginning at 7 p.m. Friday. For more dates and times, visit jazzaspensnowmass.org. And tune in for post-June experience coverage and discussion next week on part two of Curated's conversation on music and words. Here's what else is happening this week in the Valley. Tuesday at 5 p.m., Colorado Mountain College's Aspen students present their work in the exhibition Contemporary Visionaries in honor of CMC's 50th anniversary year. Wednesday, visual artists Wade Guyton, Peter Fishley, and David Weiss will be taking over all galleries in the Aspen Art Museum. That opening reception begins at 6:30 p.m. Also on Wednesday at the Belly Up, the Australian electronic group Cut Copy will play, and then the one and only Gary Clark Jr. will play shows there Thursday and Friday. All these shows start at 9 p.m. On Thursday, the Snowmass Free Concert Series continues with Brothers Keeper and John Popper on Fanny Hill in Snowmass Village. That show begins at 5:30 p.m. And then later that night, Thursday at 7 p.m., Anderson Ranch Art Center will host Critical Dialogue, Ritual, Making, and Spirituality in Art with Tom Sachs and Tom Healy. The conversation will touch on the ritual of and impulse to make art and produce physical objects. On Friday, also at the ranch, bid on artwork by faculty, visiting artists and staff, with a barbecue lunch before the bidding begins at 11:45 a.m. A preview of Theater Aspen's production of Tony Award-winning musical Hairspray will run Saturday, June 24th at 3 p.m., and Thunder River Theater Company's production of The Memory of Water continues its run with performances Friday and Saturday at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday at 2 p.m. That's all that's curated this week. For more on arts and culture, tune into Morning Edition throughout the week from 6 to 9 a.m. and visit us online at aspenpublicradio.org, where all episodes of this show live. I produced today's show with help from Kristen Kay. It was edited by Carolyn Zachariasen. Greg Lout and Jason Patton of Boulder wrote the show's theme tune, Omnicord Entrance. Special thanks to the Stefan Edlis and Gail Neeson Foundation, which aims to support the arts, community, and outreach. Continue to follow Curated APR on Facebook for news and updates on arts in the Valley. I'm Claire Woodcock at the Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk. Curated is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.